This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, September 27th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we will be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Our Statehouse correspondent Katie Lannon speaks with CAI's Gilda Geist. And we'll speak with Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. This week, we have new developments to report in the battle over what to do with contaminated water at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. And the internal parts of the Pilgrim reactor have been dismantled. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories and more. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start with the water issue. You've been reporting on the effort by Holtec, the company that owns the Pilgrim Nuclear Station, to get a state permit to discharge water from the reactor system into Cape Cod Bay. The company is now in the process of appealing the denial of the permit. Tell us about what the latest is here.
Sure. The appeal is just beginning, but recently a deadline passed for members of the public to file motions to participate in this case. It's an administrative appeal similar to a court case. And several individuals and groups from the Cape and the South Shore did file for that. There were seven filings that we know of, but there are actually many more people involved because some of the filings have a group of at least 10 people filing together. And one thing that is really notable here is the variety of groups getting involved. They include the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, the Cape Cod and Islands Association of Realtors, Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, some groups that we haven't seen every day on this, plus other groups that, of course, have already been very vocal, like Pilgrim Watch and the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. And two towns filed to participate as well, Plymouth and Barnstable. Just yesterday, I learned late in the day what the Department of Environmental Protection's response was to those requests, but I can talk about that in a minute.
Well, tell us a little bit about how people established standing to be part of this case. There were a number of ways to do that, right?
Yes. So it's a little bit in the weeds, but a member of the public can be either an intervener or a participant in the case. Getting status as an intervener is harder to do. They have to meet a higher bar of harm that would come to them. But they do get to speak in the case almost as if they were a party to the case. Being a participant is an easier status to get, but they have fewer opportunities to contribute. And then in addition to those two ways, there actually is one more. If you have a group of 10 or more people and you're arguing that there will be environmental damage, then they can file jointly. And that's kind of a special provision in the law. So now I want to talk about the results of these requests. Yeah. The Department of Environmental Protection has filed what is called an assent document for six of the seven parties that are asking to be part of this case. And it, basically what that just says is that legally they appear to meet the requirements of the law to participate. DEP did oppose one of the motions to intervene. It was from a couple who are Cape residents, and basically they got caught in a technicality. They're supposed to, when they file the document, cite the specific law that allows people to intervene in the case. They did not do that. So the DEP opposes their motion. But actually, DEP is not the final word on whether they get to participate. It's the appeals office that makes that decision.
So this is a little bit complicated. The company Holtec that wants to discharge its radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay was denied a permit by the state. They're now appealing it. Now these are folks who are joining together to join in the appeal, essentially asking the state to uphold that permit denial. You interviewed some of the people who are seeking the standing here. What are some of the points that they're looking to make?
Well, as you say, they are supporting the state's denial of a modified permit that could allow Holtec to release water from the Pilgrim reactor system into Cape Cod Bay. One person I talked with is Mary Lampert, who is a longtime Pilgrim activist. She lives in Duxbury. And she told me that what she wants to do is bring in other arguments that the Department of Environmental Protection did not use in its own denial. So she wants to add some things. The DEP really focused on one thing, which is the Ocean Sanctuaries Act. That's a state law that bans new dumping of industrial waste into Cape Cod Bay. But Mary Lampert says there's more to this. For example, Holtec's settlement agreement with the state from years ago requires them to follow other state laws that Mary says would also prohibit the water discharge in one way or another. excuse me. And then she also wants to talk about this issue of whether federal law could supersede state law in this instance. And then there she'll be trying to make the case that federal law would not supersede all of these state laws.
Now, it appears that Holtec is not standing still on this issue. You reported this week that Holtec is opening kind of a new front on the water issue, using a different state application to seek to do this discharge. Explain what this is about.
Yes. David Noyes, who is works for Holtec and attends the meetings of the state advisory panel on Pilgrim, he mentioned this Monday at their meeting. My understanding of it is that the same permit that Holtec tried to modify in order to release the water has to be renewed every 5 years, and it is up for renewal. And so this renewal application is due at the end of the year. And Noyes says that Holtec is planning to include this water discharge from the reactor system in that application.
So kind of a separate way of seeking the same discharge here.
Yeah, it's a little separate, but it's for the same thing.
Let's talk about the nuclear plant itself now, because the decommissioning of the nuclear reactor has also it's reached a notable milestone. Explain what's happening here.
Sure. So workers have been dismantling the internal parts of the nuclear reactor at Pilgrim. This process in the industry is called segmentation, but the way it's been described to me is basically cutting up the internal parts of the reactor so that they can be removed and disposed of as nuclear waste. That cutting up is now complete at Pilgrim, and the pieces are being packaged. They do need special handling because, of course, they are radioactive. Patrick O'Brien, who is a spokesman for Holtec, said that those pieces will be shipped away either by truck or truck to rail, depending on the size of the package. Truck to rail just means they go by truck to the nearest train depot that's capable of taking them on, and then they get transferred to a train for disposal.
Briefly, what do we know about what happens to these reactor parts after they leave the site here?
Yes, well, we know they are going to West Texas. Holtec has a solid waste contract with a company that specializes in radioactive waste disposal called Waste Control Specialists. Patrick O'Brien from Holtec says the reactor parts are going to be buried there in Texas.
I want to turn to another story now. Yesterday, you were in Hyannis at the airport where first responders held a full-scale emergency drill. And this was not just diagrams on a whiteboard. Explain what was happening, and then I want to ask you about some of the particulars.
Sure. This drill happens every 3 years. It is a mock emergency at the airport involving aircraft. And the first responders from various departments come and they do not know the details of the incident until they arrive on the scene. They actually get new pieces of information as they go along throughout the drill. And they get to practice many different skills. And then at the end, there's kind of a debriefing, and they come away with some lessons learned in terms of how the agencies work together with one another, with airport management, and so on. For the drill yesterday, the scenario was that an Airbus jet was landing on the runway and then collided with a propeller plane on the ground. They had roughly 28 people there playing the injured passengers. I'm told that many of them were students from either Mass Maritime or local high schools. Kind of interesting. And about six different fire departments from around the Cape responded to that. I know Hyannis Fire really was like the primary department organizing this with the airport. And then Cape Cod Hospital is part of it too, because they receive passengers. numerous other, government agencies, too many to name. And then like Boston MedFlight was involved, the Red Cross. And there are people known as evaluators on the scene who are watching to see how well all of this goes. And I remember last night you asked me, who are the evaluators? Which is a great question. I know three of them were people from Logan Airport. And of those, two are firefighters. And then another one was a retired Coast Guard commander who did this kind of work for the Coast Guard.
Now, this was very elaborate. As you say, it simulated a collision on the runway. Explain what that means. Set the scene for us. What was happening? There were different stations around the runway. Is that right?
Right. So on the runway proper, they had a couple of aircraft parked there. That was the medical triage area that the ambulances were there and they were working on the mock passengers. And then adjacent to the runway, they had some other stations for fire and extrication. I think maybe the most interesting one was the simulated fuselage, which is made out of a shipping container. They put airplane seats and debris inside to kind of simulate the chaos of a crash in there. One end had been opened up and then it was draped over with a tarp. So it was still dark inside. The firefighters had to make their way in, and there were rescue dummies in there that they had to bring out. Another station was a live fire. They were burning pallets. And then they also had some smashed cars there for firefighters to practice using the extrication equipment. And just briefly, there were a few other stations, the hospital I mentioned, an incident command center. And they also had, which I did not see, I believe it may have been offsite, a family aid center that would be like assisting, families and families of crash victims, essentially, I believe, in the event of a disaster.
We have just a minute here, but tell me, what were some of your impressions watching this take place? What was it like to witness all of this?
It's fascinating to get up close. You see the smoke and all the things they're doing. It actually brought back some memories for me because I was a mock victim of a much smaller sort of roadside crash scenario when I was young. But it really is just heartening to see the way people come together, for the common good here across all these different departments and agencies. Their mission is to keep us safe, save lives, and it's great to see that.
I know that you've got photos and video, and we're going to have them up online today where people can see them for themselves. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to CAI's Eve Zuckoff, and a little later, it will be Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Opponents of the machine gun range proposed for Joint Base Cape Cod have a date circled on their calendar. It's coming up quick. CAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us to explain why there's been a flurry of action by activists and officials to push back against the project this week. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Walk us through what happens this coming Monday and why this really matters to what's been going on around here.
So military officials with the Massachusetts Army National Guard have indicated that they're hoping to bring on a contractor for this controversial range by Monday, September 30th. And that date is so important because it's when the congressionally awarded funds that the Guard has expire. Now, these funds would be used to tell a contractor to build kind of a scaled down version of the range. We asked the Guard for details about whether they've already signed a contract, and we didn't get a response.
So the range opponents here are trying to fight any contract getting signed, right? What do they say about this fact that it appears to be going ahead?
Well, opponents of the range, like Barnesville County Commissioner Mark Forrest, that's one of the people I talked to, he said that, look, the range hasn't received critical state approval, so no contract should be signed at all. And in fact, like what he's looking at here is a range of concerns about this range. For example, there are concerns about whether it could contaminate basically the primary drinking water source for the Upper Cape and kind of beyond. And there's an outstanding Environmental Protection Agency draft report out there that really underlines many of these concerns. And that has yet to be finalized, which is what's holding up the state process. And of course, at the same time, the Guard is saying, look, we really believe in the environmental safety of this project that we've put forth. And really, this range is critical for us to be training soldiers and making that process more efficient so they don't have to drive to other New England states to get the critical machine gun range training they need.
Now, meanwhile, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod has been in and out of court, trying really to force the Guard to turn over documents that would reveal what they're hoping to get out of having this contract signed. We've been following this court case. What's the status of it?
Yeah, a judge has ruled that the documents related to the range that APCC wants to see do not need to be turned over until after October 1st. And that's if the Guard enters a construction contract before that date. APCC wanted the documents sooner, but they're saying, despite this initial setback, we will continue to press for the records about how this project is framed and programmed, as well as the cost estimates. They say the difference between the current bid and past bids that the Guard has sought raise many questions that deserve answers. So APCC says we will be back in court before October 15th to update the court on the status of kind of what's been going on between all of us.
It's fascinating how this whole story is really kind of coming to, I guess they would say, an inflection point. Like, something's going to happen here. September 30th, the money is due to run out. $9 million, the Guard has this. If they can get a contract signed before that time, they can spend the money. If it goes past that time, the money disappears. Mm. What happens if the Guard signs a contract? They don't have approval for this range, but they're going to sign a contract for some portion of it, or for what happens?
Yeah.
What do we know about what happens, I guess?
Okay, so the Guard officials have previously said that by soliciting bids, they are not impacting the ongoing state review. They are not going to go out and spend the money on a project that has not been approved. So in theory, the contract means, right, they've been able to use all the money, but they'll await next steps. To range opponents, like the same exact set of facts, you mean you've got the contract signed and you don't have approval? Mm. That is so unacceptable to range opponents. They say this creates, you know, a more watchful process because they want to make sure that the Guard doesn't kind of jump the gun, if you will, and go ahead and start building something. The county commissioner, Mark Forrest, that I talked to, wouldn't talk publicly about whether his lawyers would launch a legal fight at this point or the county's lawyers. But that is something we'll be watching.
Okay, I want to switch gears here and talk about another story that you covered this week. You've spent a lot of time talking with right whale scientists about offshore wind. You invited one of those scientists out to see an offshore wind farm for the first time. Tell us about this scientist, just to start it off.
Yeah, so I talked with Michael Moore from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He's been studying North Atlantic right whales for about 40 years. He just became a scientist emeritus. He wrote a book called We Are All Whalers. I mean, he thinks really deeply about right whales and the threats that are in front of them, like climate change and fishing gear and boat collisions. So I brought him out on this, independent trip, free to say what he thinks. This was paid for by other NPR stations. And I wanted to ask him about his concerns, his impressions, find out whether seeing a wind farm would make him feel more worried about right whales or less. And it was really interesting, the conversation.
It's a fascinating conversation. We have big pieces of it on our website. He came out to see these turbines. He was feeling uneasy about whales sharing the same waters with them. Does he feel like right whales are well protected so far?
You know, he has this like fabulous way of communicating his unease in every single answer. I think people will see that. So he started out by kind of saying like, okay, are they well protected so far? Look, there are observer programs. You know, these offshore wind companies, they have people on decks looking out for whales. They have acoustic buoys out there listening for whales. There are speed limits that regulate them. There are limits on when they can do certain you know, pile driving and other major kind of construction activity based on when the whales are supposed to be here or not. And he says, and that's all laudable and appropriate, but right whales tend not to read the books. They can show up anytime, any place. And he said, all it takes for one right whale is one bad event. Mm. So he starts at the positive, he ends negative, and in different answers, he starts at the negative and ends positive. And we just found that all throughout. And it was a really telling way to look at how right whale scientists are taking in offshore wind.
Well, kind of dovetailing with this, scientists announced that they spotted nearly a quarter of right whales in the North Atlantic, right whales in the world, I guess, right? In this unusual area this summer. Tell us about this. This news just came out.
Yeah, there are about 360 North Atlantic right whales left in the world. And this summer, scientists from the New England Aquarium spotted over 82 unique North Atlantic right whales, including 56 in one single day, while flying basically 40 to 70 miles south of Long Island. And all these flights were between the end of July and August. This is so unusual, and it's concerning. It's an area highly trafficked by boats, and it's just generally unusual feeding grounds for these animals. But, you know, in recent years, there's been this widespread redistribution of right whales because they're responding to where their prey is, and they're always adapting, and at the same time, they go into areas like this one they were in this summer where there are no mandatory speed restrictions on boats, which is, you know, concerning for them, and they keep moving into these areas that they're unprotected in.
And one of the things that Michael Moore pointed out in his conversation with you was that right whales themselves are not immune to climate change. Mm. Like, the impacts of climate change are changing right whales' behavior, where they go, where they feed, and kind of putting them at danger oftentimes as more than they used to be by putting them in navigation lanes. It's a compelling story. You can find it on our website. Folks can go over there and listen to the conversation with Michael Moore. It's CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Thanks.
Thank you.
Lone Star ticks are established on Martha's Vineyard, and new research shows the ticks are overlapping with the existing deer tick population and becoming increasingly common. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette is here to explain this story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Ethan, start off with Lone Star ticks. They bring their own particular health concerns. Explain a little bit about them for us.
Yeah, so Lone Star ticks is a species of tick that has primarily been in the southeastern U.S., but as climate change happens, they've kind of been marching northward. They got established here on the vineyard about a decade or so ago, and kind of the issue that people primarily associate with them is alpha-gal syndrome, which kind of results in people becoming allergic to red meat and other animal products.
They have been, like, their population, they were first found, you know, a little while ago on the Cape, on the vineyard, but they have been kind of growing as a population and becoming increasingly more of an issue. And in part, it's because they inhabit a different part of the ecosystem than the deer ticks that a lot of people have already been sort of trained to be on the watch for. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, for a long time, deer ticks, dog ticks to a lesser extent, were the big concern out here on the vineyard. We have one of the highest rates of Lyme disease in the country, the highest in the state. So those were kind of always the big concern. But yeah, we had this kind of new tick show up, and unlike deer ticks, which really like kind of wooded areas, you know, kind of you can be on the lookout, you know, you do your tick checks if you're going hiking through the woods. But Lone Stars are very generalist when it comes to habitat. They end up in lawns, they end up in less kind of wooded areas. Chappaquiddick especially has a lot of Lone Star ticks. I was talking to one person who says, you know, you get them just going to your mailbox. So it's not even like walking through tight hall grass or anything like that. This new study that came out by some researchers out here on the island looked at kind of, you know, what happens when these two populations overlap. And they found some interesting stuff.
Well, tell us about that, because one of the premises was that perhaps the deer tick population would go down and almost be displaced by the Lone Star ticks, but that doesn't appear to be what's happening right now.
Yeah, so in a lot of other places where there's a lot of lone star ticks, deer ticks are usually kind of in a much smaller number. Whether that's directly because of lone stars, they aren't exactly sure. But right here on the vineyard, we have the unfortunate situation where both species seem to be doing well, and they're both found here in high numbers. One scientist I talked to said, he didn't think that there was any real competition for food with the deer population out here and us as well. So yeah, it's whether that continues, it always kind of remains to be seen, if eventually lone stars do kind of rise to the top of the ticket here.
One thing that's been happening this season has been people reporting these rashes appearing on their ankles, which they think is related to lone star tick larvae. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this summer there's been kind of a rash of reports of people getting kind of these lots of bites, people getting itches, and kind of all stuff. We talked to one pharmacy. They're saying, we can't keep creams on the shelves anymore. They just keep they're flying off. You talk to people, and they say, yeah, everyone I know has these kind of bites. So it's believed to be these larvae, which, if you step in the wrong spot, you can what they dub a tick bomb, which you all of a sudden have these kind of dirt speck size larvae on you, and in the hundreds at times. And they're hard to see. You might not even realize they're there, but then you have a bunch of bites manifesting in the future. So yeah, it's been a big concern out here. So to know that, it's not just lone stars you have to worry about, it's deer ticks. The one scientist said, it just really elevates the public health risk, and people need to kind of pay attention out here.
And the permethrin-treated clothing continued to be recommended for this.
Yeah, no, the one scientist I talked to said, you can't just go and tick check yourself when you walk out of the woods anymore. You really have to kind of be doing preventative stuff and really be thinking about it. So yeah, permethrin treated clothing, and other stuff like that.
Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read all about it. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Ethan.
Chatham voters recently agreed to fund the completion of a major waterfront project, the so-called 90 Bridge Street project, which we've talked about in the past. But that's not the last word on waterfront work that needs to be addressed. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Chatham is surrounded by water on three sides, so perhaps it's no surprise that waterfront projects will continually pop up, but they come with fairly steep price tags.
Yeah, indeed. excuse me. Last May, when the town voters turned down an $11.4 million bond for a number of waterfront projects, that sort of triggered a reassessment of what needed to be done along the waterfront. And of course, the highest priority was finishing the Bridge Street project. So that was broken out. And as you said, we dealt with that at the special town meeting a couple weeks ago. The plan is at this point to break out the other projects as well, instead of going with them as one big project. That was sort of the message that voters sent to the town officials. We want to address each of these separately. And there's more than a half dozen of these projects, and they include completing a walkway at the town fish pier. A very big renovation was done of the fish pier area a year or so ago, and this portion of it was left out because the money ran out. That's one of the projects. Another major project is improvements at Riders Cove Town Landing. Now, that's a fairly big project. It's estimated around $3.5 million. Riders Cove is a popular landing for recreational and charter boats. It gets a lot of activity in the summer, and it really needs a lot of work down there. It's been sort of neglected over the years. So that's another one of the projects. And similarly, at the Barn Hill Landing in West Chatham, the bulkhead there is in need of work, and that's expected to possibly be as much as a $2 million project. That one, they're in the process of assessing the condition right now. Other projects that they're looking at include replacing a town dock at Little Mill Pond, which is right downtown, gets a lot of use. Other projects are some coastal resilience projects at Jackknife Beach, some erosion protection at Oyster Pond, rehabilitating a jetty at Mill Pond. I'm told by the town officials that there's just like a big hole right in the middle of that jetty, so that needs to be looked at. And a couple other minor projects that are on tap, but all these they total in the tens of millions of dollars, and town officials are right now trying to prioritize how these projects are going to go forward.
A lot of projects, as you're pointing to on this list, by breaking them out, kind of, instead of putting them together in one giant package, it seems like town officials are looking for ways to bring some financing to individual projects here that maybe, they can direct some of the waterfront funds towards these individual projects. Can you talk about how they're thinking about financing these?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The town has a waterways user fund. Whenever you get a permit for a mooring or a shellfish permit, part of that money goes into this fund directed towards waterfront projects. So the town officials are looking at using a significant amount of that fund for basically for like prep work for these projects, for permitting and engineering work. And for some of the bigger projects, they will be looking for grants from the state. The town has been very successful in getting Seaport Council grants for other projects, including Bridge Street. So the town will be looking at those as well. But it's likely to come down to, for some of the big projects, possibly having to go out for borrowing on them. Town officials won't know that until they get the final numbers in for these projects. But they're hoping to deal with a couple of these fairly soon, possibly in May at the annual town meeting. Others, they're looking out for to 2025, maybe even 2026, maybe even 2027. So they're being very judicious in how they're going to present the financial side of this. They want to spread it out if possible, if these areas can be maintained until they can get that funds.
That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with folks in the print and digital media. J-1 visa workers come to our region typically in summer by the thousands. They're college students, most of them from overseas, and it's said that our summer economy depends on them. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story of living conditions for one group of J-1 workers in Eastham. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
The headline of this story is 22 Sheraton workers lived in two rooms this summer. This is not the easiest story to read. Tell us about this.
Yes, I agree with you. This story was investigated and reported by our reporter, Christine Legere, who's been doing this work for many years here on the Cape. And it was not an easy story to get because we heard that something like this was going on. Chris spent quite a bit of time trying to talk to people about it. And the young workers who worked at the Sheraton Four Points in Eastham this summer, 22 of them, with only one exception, didn't want to talk about it. And this is the issue, I think, here, that these young workers from abroad, they come here and they have to have housing. And for the most part, they depend on their employers to arrange the housing. And that has to be all set up before they get here. And if they get here and they find that the arrangements are substandard, they're afraid to say anything about it because they think they'll be sent back home. Mm-hmm. In this case, what we found out was that 14 young men were living in one room in seven sets of bunk beds, and eight young women in a second room. So 22 of them in all in two rooms. Each room had one bathroom. Chris eventually was able to speak with just one of the workers from Azerbaijan, and he confirmed that that was the case.
And these J1 workers were all employed by the Sheraton, is that right? The Sheraton there in East Ham?
Yes, they all worked at the Sheraton, and they were living next door at the Ocean Park Inn, which is a smaller motel with 28 rooms. Both the Sheraton and Ocean Park are owned by Jignesh Patel of Weston, who is president of JNR Hotels, a development and hotel management company in Newton. He didn't respond to requests for comment, but the manager of the Sheraton, Dan Connell, sent us an email saying that we comply with all local, state, and federal health codes and guidelines. Now, that seems unlikely to be true in this case.
We have talked on this program with you particularly about the position that J1 workers are put in when they come here and how dependent they are on having a place to live that's provided for them and how they really aren't in a position to complain about this. And that seems to be part of what's happening here. As you say, when Chris Legere went to report this, it was so difficult to even get in to see the circumstances that these people were living in because they didn't want to reveal what was happening.
Well, exactly right. They didn't answer. One person answered the door and then wouldn't talk to her. And after that, no one would answer the door. Eventually, she was able to get a look in the room that where the 14 were staying. But when we went to talk to people at the town of East Ham health and building fire departments, basically they said that this was the first they had heard of it, and that they don't do inspections unless there's a complaint. So the newspaper filed a complaint. The building inspector and health department person went, but they also weren't able to get in and see anything. And by the time they were, all of the students had gone back to their home countries.
Can you just explain for folks who may not understand it so well what the J1 program is and how dependent the region is upon it each summer?
Yes, this is the United States State Department program, which is actually described as providing a cultural experience for foreign students. It's a cultural exchange program. It's been going for more than 60 years to increase mutual understanding between the people of the U.S. and the people of other countries. And they come here on these temporary work visas, mainly just for the summer. And the Cape Cod really depends on them. This year, there were almost 4,000 of them. Mm. Paul Nidzwicki, who's the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, calls the J1 program the underpinning of the region's seasonal economy. And many local businesses would really be hard-pressed to meet the demands of the peak summer season without these workers.
And not all of these workers are taken advantage of, obviously. You even point to the fact that the Chatham Bars Inn has employees in that same inn complex there, but they're put two to a room, it sounds like.
Exactly, yes. So Chatham Bars Inn has a lot of these J1 workers and puts them up in a couple of local motels. Two to a room, runs a shuttle bus to bring them back and forth to work. Some of the rooms are in pretty bad shape. There's another motel in Orleans, the Seashore Park Inn, that is currently in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Some of the workers there told us that they had no electricity for a few days this summer because the owner hadn't paid the electric bill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the problem is that there's really no comprehensive system set up for monitoring the living conditions of these temporary workers. And Paul Nitzwicki basically agrees with that and says that maybe the creation of a tourism district out here on the lower and outer Cape could open the way to some new approaches to workforce housing with professional management to oversee the living conditions. He says employers don't want to be landlords, and that seems pretty obvious.
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, where you can find the story. Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Issues dealing with Steward health care, a major economic development bill, and climate protests were a top news from Beacon Hill this week. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about what's been happening. Here's their conversation.
Hey, good morning.
The Steward healthcare saga continues, and yesterday the Senate voted unanimously to refer a criminal contempt charge against Steward CEO Ralph De La Torre to the Justice Department. What does this vote mean for Steward CEO, and what happens next?
Yeah, so ultimately this means that Ralph De La Torre could, if federal prosecutors go this route, end up facing jail time over his failure to appear before the U.S. Senate and testify about Steward's ongoing bankruptcy proceedings. Now, his lawyer has argued that the Constitution's Fifth Amendment protects him from testifying at a hearing that they say is designed to paint him as a scapegoat for the financial crisis at Steward, and that he's not authorized to talk about the bankruptcy anyways. But of course, senators like Ed Markey, who are on this committee, say that wants to have him testify, say that they need answers. And Ralph De La Torre was in the driver's seat when a lot of the management decisions that preceded the bankruptcy were made. So still going on here, there's also a civil contempt resolution that is still pending down in Washington, which could end up with De La Torre being compelled to show up and testify. And meanwhile, you know, here in Massachusetts, the saga of the Steward hospitals is still playing out, with the latest news here in Massachusetts being that the Healey administration is launching a pair of working groups to envision what healthcare will look like going forward in the communities where Steward hospitals have closed. That's Neshoba Valley Medical Center in Ayr and Kearney Hospital in Dorchester. So still a lot of moving parts.
Also at the State House this week, a major economic development bill was the subject of a report by the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation earlier this week. What's going on with this bill, and what does the report have to say about it?
So this is one of those bills that didn't get done over the summer when lawmakers had their deadline to really finish their formal business for the year. It's still floating around out there, and to pass it, if the House and Senate can reach a deal on their competing versions, lawmakers would have to be called back into a special formal session by the top House and Senate Democrats. So it's kind of a complicated process. The sticking point, or one of the sticking points, is really how much money to invest in the state's life sciences sector. The House wants to go bigger than the Senate does. The Mass Taxpayers Foundation is making the case that not getting the bill done really sends the wrong message to businesses, employers, at a time when other states are investing in many of these fields that are important to the Massachusetts economy, like life sciences, and the ones where the state wants to establish itself as a leader, like climate technology and artificial intelligence. And the report this week also said that, you know, it sends the wrong message about the policymaking process to leave this bill on ice, that if they can't get a bill done, lawmakers are really calling into question their ability to agree on key priorities.
Also this week, protesters gathered outside the State House to tell lawmakers they want a climate bill that is comprehensive. What do they mean by that, and how does what these activists are asking for differ from what lawmakers are working on right now?
So there have been two different sets of climate protests this week, one that involved a group chaining itself to the State House front gates, and another that was more theatrical, where activists dressed as legislators who were kicking the can. They had physical cans to kick down the road. Both of them want to see the state really restrict and move away from fossil fuels, which is not something that's contemplated per se under the bills that are still pending on Beacon Hill. The House and Governor Healey really want the focus to be on siting and permitting reforms that make it easier to get clean energy projects off the ground, while the Senate does want to go bigger. But I still don't think their bill, which would take some steps to move away from fossil fuels, goes quite as far as activists are looking for to combat the climate crisis.
All right. Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Sewage and septic systems are polluting our local waterways. It's a big story on Cape Cod. It's also a big story on the South Coast. Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light has a closer look at that, and he joins us now. Hi, Adam.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Adam, your story makes the point that wastewater solutions won't come cheap, but that putting off these projects will likely only make them more expensive for towns. Give us a sense of the costs involved here for what towns are already trying to undertake.
Absolutely, Steve. I mean, the costs are pretty exorbitant, and I know that New Bedford is obviously involved in a multi-decade project of worth hundreds of millions of dollars to resolve its combined sewer overflows. In Fairhaven, the town's working on a $70 million upgrade to the sewage treatment plant to add four denitrification tanks to the process to treat the town's wastewater. Dartmouth is looking at, you know, $50 to $100 million in upgrades alone to its wastewater treatment plant, which is now 35 years old. And their officials there are also looking to expand sewer for millions more. And in Westport and Acushnet, the cost is going to run tens of millions of dollars each for sewer expansions from neighboring towns. And in Wareham, the town is looking at, you know, more than $500 million over the next 20 years to expand sewer to half of town. So it's a really, really costly endeavor for these communities that, you know, are admittedly strapped for cash as well.
And these communities are kind of, they're being, I don't want to say they're being forced to address this, but they're really being forced to address this by both the state and the EPA, right? Are leaning heavily on them and passing regulations which make them have to step up.
Certainly, Steve. And I mean, obviously the South Coast isn't seeing anything like what you guys are seeing out on the Cape quite yet, right? We're definitely a little bit behind in our wastewater planning across the region. So that process is underway in many, many communities right now. I can think of Wareham, Dartmouth, Westport recently came out with a plan. Acushnet recently came out with a plan. So the good news is we do have some existing wastewater infrastructure. The bad news is there's really not a lot of funding for, as the Cape well knows, for these wastewater upgrades available at the federal or state levels that comes for free, right? A lot of this is borne on the back of ratepayers and town residents, especially to modernize this wastewater infrastructure that's aging out. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that some of the regulations here are forcing towns to kind of decide between doing systemic interventions like increasing sewering or passing the burden on to individual homeowners with their septic systems and they will have to pay significant amounts to upgrade their individual septic systems.
Certainly, Steve. And that's definitely a concern that you hear amongst communities across the South Coast is really bearing the cost of this as a whole. And something we actually hosted an event earlier this week, and a conversation that came up at this event, which is at the Kilburn Mill, was addressing the issue as a region and really vouching for federal and additional funding and measures as a regional whole, as opposed to going about this alone. Because as you can see, the costs that individual communities are facing are exorbitant and often need to be paid off over the course of 20 to 30 years.
I'm interested in that event. Did it seem like there's a real will within the communities to deal with this?
Certainly, Steve. There's certainly some skepticism. Obviously, there always is when it comes to spending a lot of money. But what we were excited to see was just that the investment and general willingness of communities and community leaders to take the issue head on. And communicate the need to do this and the benefits of doing this. I mean, upgrading sewer doesn't only make you compliant with regulations, it can also increase property values, make it easy to upgrade homes, lead to greater development in town. That's another concern in some of our communities that, you know, may not want to see that their rural character changed, but there seemed to be a lot of passion and interest in the issue, especially as I mentioned before. I mean, you pay now or you pay later, as the state may input costly mandates.
Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light, you've got a lot in your reporting here, including explaining how nitrogen is really the biggest part of the problem. Folks can check it out at the New Bedford Light. Adam, thank you so much.
Certainly. Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. CAI's Gilda Geist checked in with our Statehouse correspondent, Katie Lannan. And we spoke with Adam Goldstein of the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. The News Roundup is a thick risotto cooked fresh every week. It needs to be continuously stirred so it doesn't stick. I think you can guess who keeps that spoon going. Thank you, Dan. That's all we got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.